long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
This is the Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Will Miller, political scientist, now employed as Associate Vice President with Campus Labs. And joining me today is Brian Smitkowski, and unlike our weekly shows we did with Brian earlier this week, we're actually here today to talk about Brian's book that is co-written with Kirby Goidell and Craig Freeman through Prager, entitled Misreading the Bill of Rights, the Top 10 Myths Concerning Your Rights and Your Liberties. And it's an especially poignant book to talk about today, given everything going on, I think, in the United States and American politics. And just to give readers or listeners a small preview, I'd point out that, you know, when we talk about these myths that Brian and I will get into and discuss the idea of myths, we're looking at things like myth number one covered in the book, we need a bill of rights to protect our individual freedoms. Myth number four, a free press is independent from the government and the government officials it reports on. Myth number five, the United States is a Christian nation. Myth number seven, the Second Amendment was written to protect Americans against criminals. And myth number 10, killing is not cruel or unusual, but torture is. So really looking at the constitutional foundations of some of the big policy debates, public opinion debates in the United States today. So Brian, I guess to start off, what would you like to share about, you know, the impetus for this book or the big takeaways or your favorite pieces of sort of how it's constructed?
I'll start with my favorite pieces. Those include the sections that I wrote. They're clearly by far the best parts of the book. I'm assuming that Craig and Kirby are interested. Now, honestly, in all fairness, I've had the great privilege of working throughout my career with people who are just brilliant. And I mean this also, Will, you know, we've collaborated on work. And I like surrounding myself with people who are smarter than me and who challenge me and who push me. And the book kind of, you know, books like this kind of grow out of frustrations in a way that we experience. So here we have faculty, right? So Craig Freeman is a professor of communication at Oklahoma State now, and he was with Kirby at LSU previously. Kirby, who was previously at LSU, is now at Texas A&M and heads up the public policy research center there. And I'm the lowly political scientist who has dabbled in constitutional law and judicial politics for a long time. And I remember Kirby and I talking, so we used to share an office when we were in graduate school, about simple fundamental principles that when we were first learning to teach political science, and by that I mean when we were first given a room full of people and a book and told, there you go, you've got a class now, go in and try to minimize harm. We would talk about things like, if we could just get the students to understand that no rights are absolute, right? Those foundational elements. If we could just get them to read the Constitution, because we would always ask our students, like, how many of you have actually read the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence? And a bunch of hands would go up because somewhere along the lines, in high school, many of them had civics classes that required that. But what do they really remember from it? And we found out that so many students fundamentally misunderstood. And this is, again, among college students, this is a cross-section of the population that is, by definition, presumably highly educated or en route to becoming highly educated. And when we find out that they're confusing the Bill of Rights or the amendments with the Constitution, and when they're trying to develop a meta-narrative on what the Constitution means, it's all very flowery and very rosy. And so one of the things that we sought to accomplish in a book was to kind of uncover some of the myths that lead to our misunderstanding and our misreading of the Bill of Rights and address one of the fundamental problems that we have, that when we talk about a misreading of the Bill of Rights, not a lot of people really read the Bill of Rights. They just latch on to key words that they love the sound of. And that's part of the myth part here, right? That freedom of speech, freedom of press, wall of separation between church and state. We fall back on and we love these concepts, but we don't really have an understanding of where they come from, what they represent, and also how a lot of our constitutional history really reinforced a lot of structural inequalities and really didn't move us in a direction of equality the way that the sort of kumbaya version of it would tell us that we have.
Definitely. And I guess that's the first question really for me here is this idea of the myth, because to your point, I mean, I think it's interesting that obviously we know that civic engagement and civic education is such a big deal. And for those of us that work in higher ed, we're always concerned with, you know, why can more of my students identify who the latest, you know, reality TV star is, but they don't know what Ruth Bader Ginsburg looks like, or they couldn't identify their local congressman walking down the street. But the Bill of Rights is one of those things that's stressed from an early age. I don't know. I think it was, you know, middle school at the latest where I first gained exposure to what they're actually written as. And I feel like students come out of, you know, the K-12 environment with this being one of those things that's covered on most of the standardized tests. So where do we think that disconnect comes from? Or more importantly, is the disconnect almost intentional? Is it something where the founders in their infinite wisdom wrote the Bill of Rights to be broadly interpreted enough that we can sit there and fight over whether the Second Amendment actually means I can have whatever gun I want whenever, or somebody else can say there's no risk of, you know, having to worry about quarter soldiers, so why do we worry about this? So where's that come from in your eyes?
Gosh, there's a lot in there. On the one hand, you know, we know that the Constitution is sufficiently vague, right? And if we give credit where credit's due to the founding fathers and the founding generation, you know, our experience was kind of unique. There wasn't the coup d'etat where we were unseating authority within our territory. We had a Declaration of Independence, and we fought a Revolutionary War. And we had to figure out how we were going to put together a nation. And I think part of the telling of the story, right, the meta-narrative is rooted in a mythology that, at some level, I think is kind of how we talk to kids to try to get them to appreciate things by putting things in very positive terms, right? So one of the narratives about the freedom of religion is that, you know, these boats came across these oceans and people settled here. And the one thing that they didn't have was religious liberty. And they came to the United States in order to create a Christian nation and a land where religious liberty will flourish. And that's not really historically the case. We like to think that the Constitution was, you know, created by really benevolent politicians in order to establish a foundation for equality. But one of the lines in there, and this is one that I didn't write, but I'm gonna recite it because I think Kirby wrote it, and I like it very much. Jefferson, of course, was not alone, nor was he unique on this point. The U.S. Constitution was not designed to create or assure equality, but instead built inequality into its institutional framework. The separation of powers, checks and balances, and federalism were designed to perpetuate existing inequalities, not eliminate them, by making it difficult for the have-nots to use their power to redistribute economic wealth. So what we see at one end as quote-unquote learned people who have studied the Constitution and American government is how much political savvy there was, and how much political savvy was invested into creating a government that served primarily the class and category of people who served as its architects, right? So it wasn't as benevolent and kind a document. I mean, it's not this terrible thing, don't get me wrong, but it did institutionalize a lot of structural inequalities that existed. The myths come out when we talk about what a great nation we are, because like everybody else in the world, we have T-shirts that say we're number one, right? And we want to believe that. And we want to believe that our Constitution is the best Constitution. We want to believe that our Bill of Rights is the best Bill of Rights, and that we couldn't exist without them. But we look around the world and we find examples, you know, whether we look across to New Zealand or to Europe, we find examples of nation states that have endured without written codified constitutions. And likewise, as with Australia, the United Kingdom, and New Zealand, without a Bill of Rights. And that was a contentious issue as well, whether we need to have a Bill of Rights at all. Is a Bill of Rights necessary to protect individual rights? So what's happened is that we've created these myths, right, that have allowed for the dominant narratives to be told in a way that allow myths to do exactly what myths do, to give us comfort, to give us a framework. Because at its core, you know, really, what is a myth? It's a story, you know, especially one of a people seeking to explain the world around them, usually with some reference to some natural and social phenomenon and involving some supernatural events or beings. And the idea was to perpetuate ideas that are kind of widely held, but not necessarily true. So when we think about things like some of the things that we cling on the most to, like this myth of a Christian nation, there's no empirical evidence of this throughout our history. We have had people say it, and we reinforce some of these arguments, but there's no constitutional, legal, historical, or political evidence that we've ever been that nation. But there's something about telling these tales repeatedly over the course of time that gives comfort to people seeking to make sense of a very confusing world around them, and who look at the Constitution first and foremost as a thing that protects their rights rather than the thing that gives structure and meaning to the operation of government.
And I think that's an interesting point, because obviously, I mean, the Bill of Rights argument to begin with has always been able to point back to the founders. I mean, I think your book does a good job, too, of bringing up the idea of Madison's concern with even including a Bill of Rights. The guy who wrote the original Constitution is sitting there, and I believe the term he used was that it's a nauseous process to think about writing a Bill of Rights because of everything that can come with it. And this general concept of myth and even political symbolism in a lot of ways plays such a great role. I guess my question when we think back to it is, we have a lot of data and a lot of empirical evidence that you all present in the book that points to, you know, a Bill of Rights may or may not be necessary for democracy, but there's plenty of evidence, as you've said, that suggests maybe it's not. How do you think that would have changed the role of a Supreme Court or the development of American political ideals over time if that foundational document hadn't been there since original passage?
All right, that's a really good question. I will say this, that while we can make the argument that from a comparative perspective and a historical perspective, that a Bill of Rights is not necessary to a meaningful constitutional order, that's not to say that it's insignificant, unimportant, or unhelpful. I believe that in the American experience, it's something that became part of our ethos early on. And one of the problems, you know, we began to think that there was this division, right? That the Constitution proper created and empowered a government. And then we shifted gears, and then we wrote this Bill of Rights that protected the people against it. You know, again, there's this mythology there, because when we think about the first two amendments to the Constitution, one of those two is our most recently passed amendment to the Constitution. The other First Amendment just never went anywhere. So really, our First Amendment that we look at now is the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was really Amendment Number 3. And those first two were structural institutional things, not individual rights things. So what's happened is that throughout the course of history, the Bill of Rights and then the amendment process generally has been something that was established and codified by 1791 with the first 10 amendments into a protection and an articulation of individual rights, with the not so well understood principle that these were protections against the federal government. These were protections against the U.S. Congress, not the states, right? So we get that kind of perpetuation of a myth that these are rights that we have. No, these were prohibitions on the authority of the federal government. And from there, you know, we kind of hop, skip, and jump through history, and we then look at the entire Constitution and the Bill of Rights in particular through the prism of the 14th Amendment, right? The 14th Amendment begins with "Nor shall any state," and the implication there is that this is what's going to bring us up to speed and really focus on the protection of individual rights. We see at the beginning of the doctrine of selective incorporation, where more rights are brought in to be protected against impairment by the states as well. But our constitutional history has been very slow. And going back to your question about the courts, to bring this full circle, is that the Constitution gave us a fabric and a tapestry to work with. From there, we developed schools of thought of constitutional interpretation, right? There's literalism, there's interpretivism, there's non-interpretivism. There's a notion that the Constitution is understood in the words that were used as they are written down and made sense by a generation of people who are long since dead and gone. And there are others who believe that it's an imperfect document that in the hands of a responsible judiciary will be applied to, as John Marshall put it, various crises of human affairs. as Thurgood Marshall put it during the bicentennial celebration of the Constitution, as an imperfect document that gives responsible courts an opportunity to behave responsibly. And in this regard, the legacy of the Bill of Rights essentially was to expand rights. We had one negative amendment, we wrote it back out. But what happened is that we inflected in a way that reveals our biases. When we rely on myths and we reveal our biases, we then end up in troubling constitutional waters. And therefore, we get the judicial responses on issues like, how do we have a right of privacy when that seven-letter P word is nowhere to be found in the document, right? What? How do we interpret the Second Amendment, which is a fundamentally confusingly written amendment to the Constitution? Are words like cruel and unusual meant to be taken as a clause? Or, you know, because something could be cruel, but it could also not be unusual. The Bill of Rights actually gave our court a blueprint for guidance to move it in a positive direction, but also a remarkable source of confusion, Will.
I agree. And I think the confusion part's where it really gets to the interesting issues. And when I think about these myths and I think about, you know, our current political times, I think one of the most salient to me to talk about is the idea of the myth of the free press. Obviously, with the Trump administration and where we stand with, you know, public attitudes towards media and seeking out only what confirms our already held beliefs, what's the backing of that myth? What does it mean? What do we need to do to maybe move us back closer to what, you know, the founders may have envisioned as a truly free and independent press? Because today, when I look at, you know, all the media bias reports, I mean, I have the AP, which is relatively unbiased, but you can still argue there's an essential bias in what they choose to cover and what they don't, and then how reporters take the AP stories and manipulate them into what they need them to be to sell to their particular audiences. So starting with the press, you want to talk about that myth a little bit?
Yeah, you just answered it real well. Next subject? No, that's you really
beautiful.
Did well.
I read the book.
Yeah, well, thank you. You're number three. So here's the deal with the press, right? Some of the myths that we've created were that, you know, with the advent of the printing press, we suddenly would see this surge in literacy rates. With the free press, we would have a surge in public awareness. Well, the reality is that the printing press didn't really liberate learning. The printing press just made it easier for people who could read to read, right? So there was always some entitlement skew with the media, but we would say this could be true of any technological innovation of our time. So, for example, we like to say, well, everybody's got a smartphone now. Well, no, that's not necessarily true. We have a wealth of information at our fingertips. Well, not everybody has internet, right? Not everybody has a home. So we do have these social realities that we contend with. But the press also has had a complicated history because on one hand, we like to see the press as, you know, this ultimate institution for holding government officials accountable. And at some level, the press, the freedom of the press is, I think, one of the most important amendments that we have because our freedom of speech, which we love our freedom of speech, we want it to be wide open and robust and even contentious at times. We also like it to be informed. And if we use the press to broadly mean media now, we understand the vital role that a free press has in a democratic society, right? It opens up the door for a free flow of information so that we can be informed, so that we can make informed choices, so that we can hold government officials accountable. And more people, I'm convinced, know the tagline for the Washington Post, "Democracy dies in darkness now," than have ever understood it, because it's being reinforced and primed sort of in opposition to the Trump administration, because the Trump administration has posited that the New York Times and the Washington Post and a list of other things, CNN, for example, are all basically enemies of the state, right? It's fake news. And will people believe that? Well, sure, they'll believe it. I mean, a cross-section of society is going to believe that. But when you talk about withholding press credentials, when you talk about limiting media exposure, when you talk about challenging the press on a daily basis so that you are, it's almost like subliminal advertising. If at least 30 times a day I tell the people that this is fake news, will they ultimately begin to code whatever they see and hear as fake news and rely on me and me alone? This is, I think, the dynamic right now that we are concerned about when we think about the freedom of the press, which is what is the media's response to this without being purely oppositional, but how does the press demonstrate its vitality to holding government accountable and providing for the free flow of information?
And I guess what it comes back to is that idea of the informed citizenry. And I think the struggle I have today thinking about, you know, what you present as the myth, what we look at when we think about free press, I can feel very informed and still be factually incorrect.
Right.
So who gets to decide what that informed citizenry looks like? Because I think even that introduces a skew and a bias that we have to be aware of that fuels a lot of the media-based conflict today, where it's, I can look at a story, there are two objective sides, there are 300 subjective sides, and somebody's telling me I'm not informed. And to your point about media, I'm getting onto social media and spreading my thoughts or my interpretations or my beliefs, and I spread it as fact, which leads to some very confrontational discussions sometimes.
Yeah, so on the question of who decides, it's me. You know, I make that decision.
Perfect. Let that go out.
It's a pretty great world that I live in my mind. But you know, the idea of a free press is something that's not really set by anybody. The idea of what an informed citizenry is it's subjective, but I think it holds at its bare minimum this idea that if you open up the door, you're opening up the door to all sides. Because in an ideal world, we would like to say, well, the role of the media is simply to just broadcast the news, tell us what's going on, right? And we get a lot of that, actually. A lot of people romanticize the role of the media, and they'll say, you know, I'm kind of done with pundits, I'm kind of done with talk show hosts, I'm kind of done with people who have a flair for hyperbole, I'm tired of people who are overly animated. What I want is for somebody just to tell me what's going on. And the thing is, every media outlet will say that that's exactly what they're doing. Okay, so but we extend this, we'll see that whether it's the media outlets that are presumed or presented as inherently liberal or conservative are both saying we're the ones giving you the real news, we are the ones giving you the true story. You need to believe us, right? So what we have are competing versions of the truth. And the idea of an informed citizenry, this is the risk of it, right? That you open up the door for information, unfiltered, unbiased information. And if we, for example, think about this, imagine if the New York Times ran the Mueller report in its entirety, right? Completely unedited. We could say, okay, wow. In that regard, what's happening is that the media are pushing out without any editorial opinion information that we all can read. They're just a transmitter, right?
But that's the question. Let me ask about that. I think that's a good point. If they release the Mueller report in its entirety, and again, none of us have seen it, but I'm just going to work on the assumption that it was written in legalese and is a legal document. So you're right. The media is the transmitter, but do we trust that the average American is either A, going to, or B, is capable of understanding the intricacies of that as written as a raw, unedited document?
No and no. I mean, it's not going to be read and it's not going to be understood. I could virtually promise you that right now. Although somebody will probably jump online and say, I'll read it and I'll understand it. Good for you. Then we'll have a conversation, you know, an episode where we have this conversation about, so what did that mean? So that's where the other side of the media comes in, right? Which is that we get journalism, which helps contextualize and develop the story. And then we do get some biases that are going to creep in. That's inevitable. But that's what happens when you open up the door. Because what happens then is that we have selection bias. And we always talk about being outside of our bubble. But I will admit that I'm very guilty myself of paying closer attention to the news that I use, of paying closer attention to the news sources that I turn to that by my own estimation. And I'll tell myself that my own estimation is accurate and informed because I'm a political scientist. But I look to where I look and I lean to where I lean because I've found cognitive comfort in those areas. Likewise, we have people in society that will look at Fox News the same way I might look at the New York Times. And, you know, to sort of like bridge into one of the other topics that we cover in the book, which is religious liberty and perceptions of threat to religious liberty. You know, one of the things that we found in this other research that we did sort of as an offshoot of the book is that a lot of the perceptions of religious liberty, which is our new rug that we sweep everything under, is rooted in partisan affiliation. It's rooted in ideology. It's rooted in issue positions, like where you stand on topics like gay marriage. But importantly, it's also consistent with theories about elite Q-taking, that the effects of partisan affiliation are essentially contingent upon news attentiveness. So in other words, more attentive people tend to be more informed people, but you could be informed in a very skewed fashion. So the research that we did actually after the book that led to a publication on the perceptions of threat to religious liberty indicates that Republicans who pay closer attention to the news are more likely to state that their religious liberties are threatened. So then that ties us back to some of the other myths, right? So involving the press, the media broadly, depending on where you look for the information that you ultimately receive, will help you formulate your opinions and even your political behaviors on other substantive topics here that are constitutionally relevant in the form of, you know, religious expression and religious belief.
That makes a lot of sense. And on the religious belief side, I think that's another one that obviously comes up a lot. And it gets highlighted in a few different areas of the book, but that idea of, you know, the establishment of religion, the idea of a Christian nation, but then also how do we protect the individual rights of individual religions or individuals practicing their own view of religion. And we've seen this one in the news recently. I mean, obviously on the show earlier this week, we talked about some of the death penalty cases. And again, we've seen it already actually expand. I mean, your book came out a few years ago, and the focus was really on the cruel and unusual aspect, which is still present. But we're also now getting into the who gets to be in the room with me and how do we determine policy versus what's maybe morally right for individuals in these scenarios. So what's the history there for that myth?
Can you clarify the question? I'm sorry. I was paying attention to a lot of it. I thought I was with you, and then at the end,
yeah.
I
think the big one is the big point of that question is really getting at the religious side and the religious myths when it comes to whether it's practicing a religion, exercising your religion, on the assumption that some still believe we are a Christian nation. How does that play out? How can we help that play out better?
Okay, a couple of responses to that. One is, you know, when we talk about myths and misreading, when I was looking back at the book, because, you know, we were joking before this started taping, Will and I were, about how I remember watching Michael Stipe perform, and I'm thinking, you know, with REM, that you wrote these lyrics. How come you have your lyrics in front of you? You wrote the damn thing. Shouldn't you know your words? And then I look back at the book, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, my God, I'm Michael Stipe, which I'm not, because I'm not talented. Like, I had totally forgotten one of the most brilliant chapters to a title, the concluding chapter on bringing the frog of citizenship to a slow boil. I laughed because I'm like, I totally forgot that that was the title of that chapter. And I can't take credit for that. I didn't come up with that. When I was looking back at, for example, the religious liberties chapters in the book, Will, it was occurring to me that on the topic that you bring up involving the Establishment Clause, that we've got this myth that's not rooted in any way in a misreading. It's a wholesale substitution of something that gives us a greater degree of comfort and ease of access than what the Constitution says. So when we teach about the Establishment Clause, and we teach about the freedom of religion, we say there's free exercise and then there's the Establishment Clause, and we break down the Establishment Clause, we rely a lot on the imagery of a wall of separation dividing church and state. And, you know, part of the irony in all this is that, you know, the Constitution doesn't mention a wall of separation dividing church and state. That comes from Thomas Jefferson in a speech that he gave to the Danbury Baptist Convention. We are, throughout our history, really selective with who we champion. So Thomas Paine, you know, he ends up in prison in Paris. You know, he writes The Age of Reason. He also wrote Common Sense. And John Adams famously wrote, without the pen of the author of Common Sense, the sword of Washington would have been raised in vain. And so what happens is that we take people like Thomas Paine, who was, you know, a free thinker, right? We look at somebody who's advocating free thinking and reason in place of superstition, revelation, or a corrupt Christian establishment, and we relegate him to the status of an activist. But then we look at Thomas Jefferson, and we say, here's the architect of the Declaration of Independence. This is one of the founding fathers of our constitutional order and democracy. And Thomas Jefferson famously said that there's a wall separating church and state. And then we get all that comes with it and from that. And I think that's one of the problems is that we focus on things that are not constitutional, and it ultimately ends up muddying the waters so that we end up now having conversations about, well, how separate must church and state be? Is it absolute? So we have absolutism as a school of thought in constitutional law. Now we have, you know, so we have separationism rather than we have accommodationism. So the question is really about how high or impervious is that wall? So even our jurisprudence is structured in no small measure around a metaphor than it is around exclusively the constitutional text.
Now, that makes a lot of sense. I guess as we look at the current court and how they're handling some of these cases and these decisions and the public discussion they're sort of having about it, I mean, that obviously reflects a move to the right for the court as a whole. I think the Kavanaugh appointment clearly has started that path, and you have justices like Ginsburg and Kagan who are becoming maybe a little more vocal. Because they know that the left is going to need some vocalness here to make sure everything's flowing still. Did the framers account for what could happen there with those whims? Is it the pendulum approach? You know, what do you expect to happen, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years out with how that kind of develops?
I like the pendulum imagery because, you know, when I first started learning about studying constitutional law, we talk a lot about judicial activism. And judicial activism is typically, historically, relegated to an ideology, right? And we see it as liberal judicial activists, right? Created rights where they didn't exist previously. Well, the reality is that activism is a pendulum. It swings to the left just as easily as it can swing to the right. And we look at different periods in history, and I think early on in the early stages of the Republic, remember the Supreme Court was a really contentious thing. We were absolutely clear that we wanted to have a representative assembly, right? So Article 1 lays out the groundwork for the legislative branch of government. We had some real concerns about what the executive branch would look like and whether we were going to be creating our own monarch, right? We didn't want to do that. And we came up with a foundation for what becomes the modern presidency. But the Supreme Court was an institution where, you know, it was kind of expected to be the least dangerous branch of government. It was, you know, there was a lot of political discussion and debate about how it should be composed, what its responsibilities ought to be, and concepts like judicial review were not woven into the tapestry of the Constitution. So we could say that there was one cross-section of the population at the time of the founding that never would have imagined that the court would be doing what the court is doing now. But then there was another cross-section, you know, and John Marshall was part of this. So we had contemporaries whose behavior we see in real time during the early stages of the Republic who addressed what would be the historical inevitability of judicial review, the historical inevitability of being asked a question on what the Constitution means, and by giving an answer, ultimately tells the legislative and or executive branch of government that it can't do what it did, right? And we went through those growing pains. I mean, Marshall and Jefferson went through this, Marbury versus Madison, McCulloch versus Maryland, landmark cases of the time. But when we fast forward to where we are now, we see a judiciary that is often characterized and defined by its ideology, but is also defined by, in the period of time during which it occupies the bench, trying to make sense of a complex document for a needy society, right? And so courts are taking on issues that are very contentious. And so religious liberty questions begin to grow. They begin to change. And we move away from whether the government can establish a religion, which is a pretty simple and basic question, to is what this church is doing constitutionally permissible under the Establishment Clause? Is the government's accommodation that it's making to religious liberty a violation of the Establishment Clause? Are the beliefs and practices that we see currently, are they part of what would be considered to be the free exercise of religion? Because everybody who has religious convictions likes to believe that theirs are the good ones and theirs are the right ones. But are there parameters that regulate behavior? You know, here we typically fall back on the old saying that, you know, your right to your religious beliefs are nearly absolute, but your behavior is always subject to regulation. But right now, for example, in the state of Texas, there's legislation that's been discussed and debated involving whether physicians, accountants, lawyers, and other very prominent agents in society can abide by their religious convictions and deny services, including medical services, to citizens based upon their religious beliefs and their religious convictions. And there are some very strong sentiments and considerations that lie in there, because ultimately we could have people who do not have a right to some basic services like healthcare and legal representation if they could say, oh, under the umbrella of the freedom of religion and religious liberty, I don't have to respect your constitutional right.
And that's, again, I think where it really gets into the difficulty that the Bill of Rights does provide us is obviously your book's focused on here, but the fact that one person's interpretation can sway that entire conversation. The approach I take versus an objective outsider view, which again is always difficult. I mean, that was the hardest part for me about being a faculty member for a long time was, you know, I'm not supposed to represent my views in this classroom, but I also do have views. So how do I balance this out without, you know, pretending that I'm some individual without feelings on these issues that I'm speaking very passionately about? And I think another place here, you know, we talk about the religious side, but one last myth to kind of talk about for me that's really interesting is the privacy myth, where obviously we live in a society today where, you know, I would say that even as a fairly anti-government, anti-Big Brother person, I enjoy the perks of having my privacy violated when it means that, you know, Netflix recommends a good show they think I'll like based on everything else they know about me, but I don't like the idea of having my phone wiretapped. What's that myth like, and where do we come at it from?
Well, the irony is that the public is ridiculously magnanimous when it comes to, like, NSA stuff. It's almost like we're indifferent to it, that the current generation, and I had this conversation with my students, and I said, are you ever kind of freaked out by the accessibility to your private information that the government might have? And they almost shrugged their shoulders, like, yeah, we're from that generation of people who just click OK when we, you know, install apps and load programs and things like this. And it's sort of like, you know, no harm, no foul. And I'm like, wow, okay, so we're potentially on dangerous ground there. But the other side of it is, you know, with regard to privacy rights, you know, the initial question, you know, again, this word was never mentioned in the Constitution. But is it in the what we call the penumbras, right? The penumbras are kind of those shadowy areas that are neither so illuminated by the light or hidden in darkness that they can't be discovered. And the answer is, you know, clearly yes, that we have a constitutional right to privacy, although that word is not mentioned. Now, to some, the argument would be if the word's not used, the right doesn't exist. My counterargument is that we have synonyms, we have antonyms, we have a thesaurus, right? So we can understand that words represent categories of rights. So privacy rights, you know, come out of a case, you know, Griswold versus Connecticut involving contraceptive devices being used by a couple, in this case, a married couple, and a privacy right that exists between patients and their doctors. Now, almost everybody would agree if you characterize privacy rights as, should the conversations that you have between with you and your doctor be kept exclusively between you and your doctor? Most people would say, yep. They don't want the next person coming in being told, oh, wait till you hear what she had or what he did, right? That's not their business. But what we say about that right to privacy also involves a regulation of one's own autonomy to make a decision about whether to carry a fetus to term, right? Whether the right to privacy isn't just the home or the vehicle or the doctor's office, but it's one's own body and what happens within one's own body. Then we start getting the other issues that get folded in, like tolerance for abortion, for example. So privacy is one of those ones that has, you know, taken us into the realm of, you know, abortion jurisprudence. It's firmly there. An increasingly conservative court will be increasingly inhospitable to the claims that women have about the current status of the law, which is that laws cannot constitute an undue burden to the right of the woman, right? It goes out beyond there. And here we see the other inflection points that pull us away from privacy rights and into the realm of morality and ethics, and again, religious beliefs and convictions coming into play. And we have a very divided court, and increasingly so for the near future.
I was going to say, that's my question there, is with that court, where do you think that falls 10 years from now? Do you see the court widening? Do you see the court losing that near conservative majority? And again, obviously there's a lot of variables in play there, but given the changing demographics and presidential elections around the corner, what do you think will happen?
Well, you know, Mitch McConnell, again, love him or hate him, he knows the rules. He knows how to bend them, break them almost to their fracture points. He's a master strategist. And so we saw a clearing of the way for lower level appointments to be expedited through the Senate. What we are not seeing, of course, is the application of some of those rules at the higher level Supreme Court, federal circuit court decisions. I'm sorry, courts, for example. Right now, if we look at the composition of the court as it is and the most recent appointees to the court, it's part of a strategy to not just get the people you want on there, but get the young people you want on there. So when you ask about 5 years or 10 years, Will, if you're entering the court in your 50s or 60s, you're still kicking, you know, with a lot of vitality in your 70s and into your 80s. So I think right now this is part of a large, you know, political agenda. This sounded very conspiratorial, but it is a political agenda. We saw this with Reagan, and we're seeing it, you know, now. Is it's not just what he wants in terms of the democratic will of the people, in terms of the elections to the legislative and executive branches of government, but who are you going to put into the legislative and executive branches of government to guarantee the kind of court that you're going to want long after everybody else has voted out of office? So right now, it's a very there's a very clear agenda to stock the court as much as you can with conservatives, so that when the other winds of change blow through and you get Democratic majorities in the House and the Senate, and you get a Democratic president, the laws that they pass are ultimately going to be scrutinized by a conservative judiciary. I think in 10 years, we're not going to see a sea change that swings the pendulum back in a liberal direction. I don't see that happening within 10 years.
Perfect. And that makes sense. And again, I think part of it is if we look at the likely contenders to walk away next, you know, public speculation is pretty clear that Ruth Bader Ginsburg at this point is likely holding out hope for 2020. And the interesting part there will be what happens with Clarence Thomas, because I can see a very protracted political debate where if Trump were to lose re-election, that Thomas would immediately resign in an effort to be replaced by Trump, which would lead to all sorts of fun political debates during that lame duck period there.
Oh, my God.
And that would lead to Mitch McConnell having his absolute field day in terms of just being the master of finding loopholes and options within the rules to take full advantage of.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I think it's one of those, you know, fasten the seatbelt is going to be a bumpy ride, because, you know, when we wrote this book in 2015, and so many things have, I don't want to say so many things have changed, but the current political environment is really making us go back to some basics and say, okay, think about the death penalty debate. You know, we're not talking about cruel and unusual punishment anymore. We're talking about Did you get your appeal done? Did you get your stay of execution in, you know, with a reasonable time for us to act? Because the court is presently, in the cases that literally just came to it, kind of hostile to the idea of people who bring something too late to the game, right? So even the topics that we're discussing on things like the death penalty, we're not talking about the same things. Death penalty jurisprudence is changing literally before our eyes. Religious liberty jurisprudence is changing literally before our eyes. The relationship between a free press and the government as a political game is changing before our eyes. And so, like everybody else, I'm intrigued by how the events of our day are going to unfold. And I think it's one of those things that we'll always have something to think about and we'll always have something to write about.
Absolutely. I think that's the benefit here is obviously this is, I mean, your book makes this clear. It's not a settled debate. The myths are there. Yeah. And if it's a myth, we can change myths as time goes, as long as we get enough people to hear the message and believe.
That's right. And, you know, myths, and then, you know, to be honest, you know, as we're discussing this, think about what Donald Trump is doing. This idea of make America great again, right? He's perpetuating a myth that's predicated upon this romantic notion that at some point in our history, some undefined moment, for unspoken reasons, we were great, and we want to make America great again. So that's creating sort of this heroic journey of a mythological leader that's seeking to restore us to a course that makes us the world's greatest democracy, right? And so we're seeing sort of a retelling of some tales literally on a daily basis. I mean, just be careful with those windmills out there, man. The sound of those will give you cancer.
I love it. Any last thoughts, Brian, that you want to share about the book or what you want listeners to know about it?
It's awesome. It's the best thing you'll ever read. To be perfectly honest, Will, I appreciate you taking the time to have a conversation about it. And it's less about the book than the fundamental principles, which is, you know, what we're trying to do with the book is to get people to think, is to read the thing. So before we can have, so instead of having a misreading of the Constitution, instead of misreading the Bill of Rights, let's at least resolve to read it, right? We have, I think, a moral responsibility to read the Declaration of Independence, to read the Constitution, to read the Bill of Rights. And then we can read about it to understand it better, to minimize the likelihood of misreading and misunderstanding. And then we could start separating out for ourselves the myths and the impact and the consequences of the myths, and hopefully move in a direction where the Constitution and the Bill of Rights helps facilitate a vision and actualization of a better government and a more informed citizenry.
Well, awesome, Brian. I think everybody can get behind that message. So that's it for our episode and our interview with Brian Smankowski. Thanks for listening. We hope you like what you heard. Listener support would keep the show going, so we obviously appreciate any support you're willing to offer. Subscribing to the show also helps, as is sharing our episodes. Easy to do right in the podcast app, using the triangle typically. Word of mouth, leaving reviews and ratings on iTunes help us out as well. If you've got questions, comments, corrections, or just a random thought you want to share, you can reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. Our Facebook page, where you can interact with us, message us, and see what we post throughout the week, is facebook.com/politicsguyspage. And we're also on Twitter at Politics Guys. The executive producers of the Politics Guys are Michael Baranowski, Jay Carson, Trey Orndorff, Will Miller, and Bruce Johnson. This show is produced by Will Miller. We'll be back with a new show on Saturday, and we hope you'll join us then.